Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. On this day, when we honor the American worker, it's also appropriate to note the role that American industry as a whole, with its dedicated workforce, helped save the nation before, during, and after World War II. It started when President Roosevelt decided that the United States could not stand idly by while Hitler was beginning to ravage Europe. This country, reeling from the Great Depression, was vastly unprepared for war until FDR decided that it could not continue. He sounded the call to the nation's industrial giants to give us the wherewithal to get into the game, if it came to that. I'm Don Marsh. The remarkable story of how this country prepared itself for war and sustained the effort is told in historian Arthur Herman's book, Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. In this holiday rebroadcast, he tells us the story. Arthur, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a real pleasure.
What a fascinating story this is, and it's unfortunate until now that so many people really don't know that story.
No, they don't. And I have to tell you, of all the books that I've worked on, I think this has been really the most fascinating one in terms of the research, in terms of meeting people who were part of the story, talking to grandchildren of the leading characters in my book. I just had an enormous pleasure in it. And what I really liked about it was that it was really for the first time in so many years that someone has told the story of the other half of the Greatest Generation, the people who worked in the factories and shipyards and plants all across the country, including here in St. Louis. And here was a chance to really tell their story and what their lives were really like.
The country was really buzzing during this time, wasn't it?
It was. And it came from basically a standing start. And that's one of the, I think, important points about the book and the story, is when you come to realize that we had to turn around a country which was still bruised by a decade of depression, industrial plant in very sad shape, the mood of the country. We don't want to get involved in dealing with what's happening in Europe or think about preparing for war. FDR had a lot of uphill work to do, and the main characters of the book are the people he sort of put into harness to help him get the country and American industry and business geared up for what was coming.
Let's talk a little bit about what kind of shape the country was in then, and in terms of being prepared for war. We could all see what was going on in Europe and hoping, as you just said, not to become involved.
Right.
But we were not prepared if that day came.
No. And you have to, at the very beginning of the book, what I try to do is put the reader in Roosevelt's situation. You're sitting in the Oval Office. It's May of 1940. You're watching the headlines. France is collapsing under the Nazi onslaught. Britain may well collapse. Its army is trapped at Dunkirk. It may never escape. And your gut tells you and your military advisors tell you war is coming maybe in 2 years, maybe less than that. And you are totally unprepared. You have and no way to prepare. You have the 18th largest army in the world at that time, the United States did. Holland had a bigger army than we did. Hungary, Argentina had bigger armies. You have no defense industry in which to gear up to your Air Force or to build the other kinds of tools that are going to be necessary for this new kind of warfare that's coming. You've got nothing. What do you do? Well, what you do is what Roosevelt did.
Made a couple of phone calls.
You make a couple of phone calls. Right. You call the people who actually do know something about large-scale enterprise, and that is America's biggest and most innovative corporations. And he calls Bill Knudsen, president of General Motors, and says, how do I do this? How do I get this country geared up and ready for the kind of war that's almost certainly going to be coming in the next 2 years?
Let me just back up just a bit.
Sure.
Again, to how unprepared we were. What did we have in terms of resources? Tanks, the kinds of equipment that is necessary. Didn't I read in your book that we had ammunition in storage still from the Civil War?
Well, we had machine tools in government arsenals. And you imagine across the country, you've got basically six or seven government arsenals that are really handcrafting machine guns, 1903 Springfield rifles, tanks. I mean, the tanks that were turned out, we had set up in 1939, as I explained in the book, they set up for the first time a tank division. You know, Germany by this time has dozens of them, the Panzer divisions.
Dozens of divisions.
And, exactly. And under the command of young Brigadier General
Patton.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And Patton basically realizes these tanks are falling apart. He's got no nuts and bolts. He's got no spare parts. And he asked the quartermaster, what am I going to get these things? And they said, it may be years before you see it. So he goes, and this is a story he told during the war, he goes to the Sears and Roebuck catalog and orders the nuts and bolts and supplies himself. That's the kind of shape we were in.
And he paid for them himself, didn't he?
He did. Exactly.
It's just remarkable.
It is.
That's the kind of position.
And then
we
if you look at in terms of what we had, is we had no Air Force. We had an Army Air Corps, had about 1,500 flying machines, we can call them that. A lot of them were biplanes. A lot of them were trainers. The Nazis at this point, 1,500 planes, that's how many planes they're putting in the air every day to bomb Britain. Totally, as I said, we're going from a standing start. And he turns to Knudsen and he says, how does he do it? And the rest of the book really explains how Knudsen and his colleagues then got the process started and got it sustained and growing.
We'll certainly get to that in just a moment. But I want to just contrast what you've said about what we had and how well prepared we were. When it was all over, at the end of the war, we had 86,000 tanks, 286,000 warplanes, 41 billion rounds of ammunition, 8,800 naval vessels, 5,600 merchant ships, and, of course, the atomic bomb. All of this produced during
That's right. 4-year span. We transformed ourselves from the 18th largest military power to the number one military power with weapons no one had even conceived of in 1940. Don, we were building 8 aircraft carriers a month in American shipyards by 1944. Just imagine if you were to present to our current Pentagon the ability to do that kind of, to generate that kind of machinery and tools of war. That's where we ended up. And it is, I think, the great industrial miracle of maybe of all time, certainly of the 20th century.
What did Mr. Knudsen do to get the ball rolling?
What he did was he said, look, don't try to do this with a command-down approach, which a lot of people in the administration, including in the War Department, really wanted to do. And that was, we're in a desperate situation. Let's throw the lever, go completely from a civilian economy to a wartime economy, in effect, nationalize those parts of the sectors of the industry that we're going to need to build ships and tanks, begin a process of telling you're going to build this and you're going to build that. He said, it's not going to work. You're just going to create all kinds of problems down the road. And what he was really saying was that it's what you tried to do with the New Deal, trying to direct everything from Washington. It really didn't work out. Let's do a different approach. Let's do a bottoms-up approach. In other words, what we'll do is we'll harness the most productive and innovative companies. We'll get them to figure out what they can produce best. I'll make some phone calls. I'll shake some hands, and we'll get those companies going. And we'll add the military orders. And this was the key. We'll add the military orders to the civilian production that's already underway for automobile companies, for example, to the steel companies. And what will happen is as the military orders begin to build up, they'll convert. They'll have to convert voluntarily to get those contracts. And by the time things get going, we're going to have a full-scale military production underway. And if war really does come, you'll really be prepared. Knudsen said, give me 18 months, and my colleagues and I will have more war equipment than you can even imagine. Now, Roosevelt had said in a speech that May, he had said he was looking that America was really going to be ready for war, would have to have 50,000 planes a year. All the aviation experts all said, no, it's impossible. Charles Lindbergh says, he's dreaming. This isn't possible to do this kind of thing. Knudsen sort of said, give me those 18 months and we'll put that 50,000 plane figure in the shade. And we did.
And this was in 1940.
This is in the summer of 1940.
Long before Pearl Harbor.
This is a year and a half, which is an interesting because, in fact, if you look at the chronology, we're talking about a year and a half before Pearl Harbor. And what Knudsen was able to do was to get those 18 months so that by the time the bombs drop on Pearl Harbor, we're actually have a war production levels that's approaching Nazi Germany's, which has been fully mobilized for war for well, basically for about 6-7 years. We'd already jumped that far ahead. That's what Knudsen had promised, and that's what he was able to do.
You know, I have to ask this question at this particular part of our conversation.
Sure.
There are some historians and non-historians who think that President Roosevelt actually knew that Pearl Harbor was coming, and that in order to get out of the Depression, we probably ought to get into it and do just the kind of thing that you're talking about. Any of your research indicate any of that?
Yeah. You know, it's very funny. It is one of the questions I keep getting asked about this and about the discussion. And quite apart from the fact that there is absolutely no evidence that Roosevelt or anyone in the Navy Department or the War Department had a clue that the kind of attack was coming or that Pearl Harbor would be the target or that it would be as devastating as it was. Set all of that aside. Again, think about your position here of Franklin Roosevelt in the summer of 1940. Where's his mind focused? It's not on the Pacific. It's on Europe. That's where the threat is. That's where the threat is perceived. That's where if Britain falls, they're going to have a navy which is going to be able to patrol the Atlantic shore of the United States.
The Germans would.
Yeah,
yes.
You bet. They'll have control not only of the Royal Navy, they'll have control of the French Navy as well at the same time. Overwhelming maritime supremacy in the Atlantic. That's what you're trying to prevent. That's why you're trying to keep Britain going. The idea that you would then, if you want to get this country into war, that you would then allow or provoke a conflict on the other side of the world as a means to do it would just be so far beyond the sort of capacity of understanding of a man like Roosevelt and the way he thought about these kinds of issues. He's a very shrewd strategist. He's a student of Admiral Mahan. He knows about how sea power works. So the idea that he would run that kind of risk is, I think, so far beyond the realm of possibility. And I think, too, here, Don, there's another point about this. I think for a lot of people who ask that question, there have been books that have been written about it, forget about this period in between. You know, we were gearing up for war already. In fact, by September of 1941, we were pretty close to being fully engaged in warfare with Nazi Germany. Roosevelt had his military buildup underway. He had his, if you like, casus belli, right? Cause for war already on the map here. There's no reason why he would have thought something was going to happen in the Pacific, let alone provoke it.
Of course, if you were preparing for war on the scale with which this country was doing it, you didn't need the war because the economy was going to be affected certainly by the preparation.
Well, I think that was one of the big surprises, in fact, in many ways, certainly to the administration and also to industry. In fact, Knudsen was the one person who realized this could be a turnaround for the American economy, quite apart from the military buildup. And he gives a speech. This is in the fall of 1940. He gives a speech in Washington to a business audience, and he says to them, in order to bring this war preparation, we're going to basically have to replace the entire industrial plant in the United States. And they're shocked. But what he's saying is we've been in this sort of fallow period for a decade, thanks to the Great Depression. What he saw was the possibility now in converting to wartime production, to get businesses up and going again, to get those animal spirits, which are the basis of a free market economy, focused on a new set of problems, a new set of issues, and that the conversion to this new kind of production would have this long-term benefit to the American economy. And I have to say, as I explain in the book, he turns out to be correct about that.
And we'll get to this later, but he was also correct after the war as to what was going to
happen. Exactly.
People misread what was likely to happen there. Right. We are talking with Arthur Herman. He is the author of Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. A fascinating story it is, the industrial mobilization to take on Hitler and ultimately Japan, in World War II. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion with Arthur Herman, the author of Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. And I think the title pretty much tells it all. Arthur, were these titans of industry, were they motivated by patriotism or profit?
I think initially they were motivated by Bill Knudsen. And this is one of the things I think Knudsen, who was a hugely respected figure in the 1930s and 40s, he's almost forgotten today. And I think it's important to realize just what a what a giant he really was in American industry, not just in the automotive industry. He was a Danish immigrant who had come over to this country with nothing. First job working in a Bronx shipyard with a riveting gang. Got a job in a bicycle factory in Buffalo making parts for Henry Ford's Model Ts. And his skill and ingenuity in organizing the factory floor there made Ford bring him all the way to Detroit to help him set up his new plant there, the wonder of mass production at Highland Park. Later on, they have a falling out, and he goes on to Chevrolet and then to General Motors. But in 1940, when Roosevelt calls, Bill Knutson is more respected in the automobile industry than Henry Ford, because people realize that he's been the real father of mass production. He's the man who, for example, developed the annual changes in automobiles. He figured out a way in which you could do this, not just as a marketing tool, but also how you could organize a factory floor to in order to do that without having to shut down and retool each time you were making these kinds of changes. He's a production genius. And so when he starts, at Roosevelt's behest, making calls to colleagues of his, K.T. Keller at Chrysler, Alvin McCauley at Packard, and says, I need your help. Can you make tanks? Can you make machine guns? Can you make aircraft engines? Even though a lot of them, you know, they're Republicans, Roosevelt's a Democrat, he's been attacking business for a long period of time, a lot of them aren't really sure if this country should be geared up for war. But when Big Bill Knutson calls, you answer. And you say, absolutely, Bill, I trust you, and let's work together on this.
So he was the orchestra leader, and yep, they had to bring in many players. You've just mentioned a couple. What were some of the other major corporations that became involved?
Well, and here is where Knutson was smart. As I explain in the book, what he did was is he went to the corporations that had engineering divisions, independent engineering divisions, because he was going to be asking companies, like the car companies, to make things they'd never made before. Tanks, machine guns, field artillery. Nobody else was making this stuff after World War I. It all been disappeared. But he knew that if you had lots of engineers at work, that they could take these things. If there's one thing American engineers love, it's a challenge. And so you give them something and say, this is probably impossible, but I figure you can have a shot at it. They will carry through and deliver it, not just on the deadline, but if they possibly can, before the deadline. Automobile industry, which he turns loose, the biggest employer also in the country with a huge industrial plant that's ready to go for this. He goes to, of course, the steel industry and aluminum industry, which are crucial for making the raw materials for this. He goes to the big construction firms. And one of the other major characters in the book is Henry Kaiser, the man who was really the mastermind behind the building of Boulder Dam.
Didn't he say, find a need and fill it?
Fill it. That's yeah, right. That was his ticket to business. And here's a need. Government is going to need all this kinds of equipment. And so he finally gets the contract to build the Liberty ships, the ships that are going to carry all of this war production material that's being built in these factories. Has got to go somewhere. It's going to go overseas to Europe first, then after Pearl Harbor to the Pacific. And it's the Liberty ships that carry it. And he brings, even though he's never built a ship before. In fact, the joke was that Henry Kaiser didn't know. He called it the front and the back of the ship instead of the stern and the prow. But he had this skill of being able to figure out how you could, in effect, mass produce ships. He cuts the time to build Liberty ships. I explain how it's done in the book. He cuts it from 222 days to 5 days. That's the kind of engineering and kind of just innovative skill and thinking that Knutson knew existed out there with companies and corporations that he could cut in, that he could, in a sense, tap into by doing this. And not just with the big companies. He knew that once you got a contract to a company like a DuPont, like a General Motors or a Ford, that what would happen is that this big subcontractor network, all of the smaller companies, distributors and suppliers who make specialized parts would also now be mobilized. And so when you made one big government contract for tanks with one company, there would be 500, 1,000 other companies that would suddenly be mobilized and now begin to produce things all across the country in order to meet this new need that the government had.
It's what we're calling today the ripple effect.
Absolutely, the ripple effect.
What was General Motors doing about cars during this time? Did auto production just stop, and did the production of refrigerators just stop at these places?
Well, at first they didn't. And this was, again, part of the whole debate that was taking place with Roosevelt and his advisors, who sort of said, no, what are we doing still making civilian cars when we should shut everything down, rip out the machine tools, and gear up to make army trucks and tanks, etc.? And Knudsen said this is a big mistake. He said, first of all, what will happen is if you shut down civilian production now, this is in the fall of 1940, when things are just getting underway, he said, the machine tool makers will scatter. They'll go to the West Coast where they can get work in the aviation companies, all of and other and shipyards. Keep them busy here. Again, add the military orders on top. And he said, you know what? When war does come, you're going to need those civilian cars. Who's going to chauffeur around the generals, right? And the Pentagon, well, later the Pentagon bureaucrats. You're going to need those cars. Likewise with the planes, you know. Companies like we have to remember companies that are today, you know, the core of the military industrial complex, Lockheed and Boeing. These were commercial companies. And they were, even though they were getting military orders, they were still producing civilian planes. And again, the War Department, oh, my God, what are we doing? And he said, you're going to need those civilian planes. You're going to need the puddle jumpers to fly generals around in order to go visit places in the country and overseas as well. And he understood that the key to growth, whether you're talking about the growth of a modern military machine that was so desperately needed or economic growth, is productivity. Mm-hmm. That you produce, you lower the costs, things are produced in larger numbers. That's the process of change. And that was just waiting in the American economy to be turned loose again after a decade of depression. And the war production, he felt, was the way to really get that back into harness.
I want to go to the phones in just a moment, but before I do that, let me ask you about St. Louis and the role of St. Louis or our region played in this overall effort. I know we're going to get some calls with people with strong memories of some of that. You tell that part of the story.
Well, St. Louis was a classic example of a industrial town which had taken a beating during the Depression, but in which you have, on the one hand, existing corporations that were ready now to sort of gear up for war production. I can think of a couple right off the bat. One was Curtis Wright, which had a big plant out here in St. Louis before the war. But when the need now for aircraft engines and airframes comes out with Knudsen's, as Knudsen's machine begins to build, begins to increase in its power intensity, that plant now becomes surrounded by one about four times that size. $28 million went into building a whole new Curtis Wright facility and makes it part of the anchor of a post-war St. Louis economy. Another company, Western Cartridge, the Olin Corporate family owned that. They gear up for major military production. The one that may be a surprise to some people, because I say these are companies that are already involved in what we'd think of as sort of munitions or military production, but so many other companies that shifted over, made unexpected jump. In the book, I have a chart which shows you what, you know, suggestions that were made. If you make these kinds of things, you could make this. If you make lawnmowers, for example, you could make shrapnel for artillery shells. And that was the Mallinckrodt Chemical Company, who gets a visit by another St. Louis icon figure, and that's Arthur Compton from Washington University, who'd been brought in to gear up for how are we going to turn this scientific experiment called nuclear fission into a real industrial project, into a weapon of war, and the desperate need that they had for uranium. Mallinckrodt had never worked with uranium at all, but Compton knew that they had worked on purifying and processing ether and a number of other very hazardous kinds of compounds. And he goes to Edward Mallinckrodt. He said, this is what we need. We need to process uranium and get it set ready for enrichment and the new facilities that DuPont and Union Carbide are building for us out at Oak Ridge. And he says, sure, I'd never worked with uranium. He said, how much do you need? 60 tons. And in the process, what he does is, what Mallinckrodt does, is not only create a whole new way to process this uranium, but as Ben, someone from the War Department told Arthur Compton afterwards, he said, it's the first time in my life in which we've had the product delivered before the contract was signed.
And I have to say that many people in this area have been living with the consequences of that work ever since, because there have been many concerns at the old Mallinckrodt plant about some of the residue and waste.
Was that from that uranium?
From that time, yeah.
And it was a dangerous work for all of these companies. Sure. One of the reasons why DuPont was brought in was because they had worked with hazardous materials. But it was wartime, and there was the sense of the race against the clock, particularly when it came to the bomb, whether the Germans would get it before they did. So you had companies that were able to sort of extend what they were already doing. You had companies that converted to new, unexpected things, refrigerator companies that make machine guns, for example, a jukebox company, Rockola, that shifts to making M1 carbines. Then you have all the new businesses that sprang up, 500,000 new businesses that arose during the war. Sometimes guys just from in their garage who develop a new device that speeds up welding of ships or speeds up process in the assembly line. They get a loan from the government, and suddenly they're in business. And a lot of them went on to go build careers and companies for themselves after the war.
So you have people like Hedy Lamarr at that time, the actress who was developing a form of radar.
You've got people like that. And I got an email from a guy from St. Louis by Dominic, after he read the book, and said, you know, my father did that. He'd worked in a small metal sheet company. When they didn't want to do the government contract, because, again, we're not at war. This was in 1940. He borrowed some money from a bank, set up his own company, and got a contract with Bendix in the process. It happens all the time.
Let's go to the phones. I think Max, calling from Baden, wants to reference one of those operations that developed here as a result of this mobilization. Go ahead, Max.
Yes, good morning, sir. And that gentleman, what's his name again? Goods... GM?
Knudsen, yeah.
Knudsen, boy, he's an unsung hero.
He really is.
Okay, real quick, and speaking of GM, a plant here in northwest St. Louis, the St. Louis Small Arms Plant, it was also called the GM Small Arms Plant because GM managed it, and it was on property next to the big GM plant that existed until the early 80s in St. Louis. And this is an example of pre-Pearl Harbor industrialization, because it was built, I don't know how long before Pearl Harbor, maybe a year or two. I'm not sure of that.
That's probably right. Right.
But my mother remembers as a young girl, this property had been dedicated to be a city park. This would have been the city park on the edge of the city. And somewhere along the line, it wasn't a city park anymore. I'm not sure the details. But this was a massive plant making small arms, and it was running before Pearl Harbor, I've always been told, because it was going to Europe. Now, that's another whole story about how Roosevelt had to fight just to send stuff or sell stuff to Europe. And something that I'm a crank on here in St. Louis, yes, you know, we revere Mr. Lindbergh. But Mr. Lindbergh gave many, many speeches, isolation speeches, into some highly questionable groups, thwarting, not that Roosevelt was trying to get into war. I know how it looked, but that's something, that's our dirty little secret in St. Louis. Mr. Lindbergh, it's a historic fact, but whenever this stuff comes up about FDR and knowing... of course, there again, you're talking to the grandson of a woman who had a picture of FDR and the Pope in her house. But whenever this comes up, this dirty stuff about Roosevelt and knowing the war was coming, it really rings hollow in St. Louis when one of our big heroes, night after night, London was being bombed the hell out of, and we couldn't do nothing.
Max, I'm going to interrupt you here because we have a time constraint, but I think the point you want to make about Lindbergh is something that our guest will certainly come
back. And I talk about this in the book. I mean, he was very much part of the isolationist camp. And Max is absolutely right. There was huge isolationist sentiment in this country, including in the business community. There's absolutely no doubt. And this was part of why Roosevelt had much of this, as I explain in the book, much of this war production development had to come without any kind of authorization from Congress, which is why Knudsen's informal networks were so important, because he was able to get people to convert parts of their plant, to expand the plant simply by a handshake. They didn't have to get money authorization, money from the War Department. They didn't have to ask for Congress to authorize this thing. This was important. There were he and Jesse Jones, who was the head of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the other probably the most important businessman in Roosevelt's administration, would arrange for loans for that process, government guaranteed loans to build to expand those that plant capacity. But the struggle here to get this country ready for war, when this overwhelming sentiment, including in Washington, runs the opposite way, really made it an heroic effort.
We should point out, too, before I take this next break, that not all of what was produced initially was just for us.
No,
we were producing it for some of our friends on the other
side. Absolutely. And Roosevelt had to explain this, that this was being done really because if Britain collapsed, then the threat would come hang over our heads in a really direct and alarming way.
This was lend-lease. What we're
the
talking.
Lend-lease, yeah. Right? And Knudsen was really one of the key architects of the lend-lease, because he realized that there was no way that Britain would be able to pay for all of the equipment that they were going to be getting, and he said there has to be some other way to finance this, and the way in which to do it was to basically do it as a lease arrangement with Great Britain.
And in the Soviets also?
And the Soviets, when they're invaded by Hitler, they become part of it. And the Lend-Lease, as I explained in the book too, this wasn't just sort of, you know, some equipment, war equipment. This was also foodstuffs. It was essential kinds of fuel oil, raw materials. During World War II, our Lend-Lease efforts flowing out of the United States supplied about one-fifth of the Soviet GNP. We kept the Soviet economy from collapsing because they had to convert completely to wartime production. Great Britain, every fourth meal that a Briton ate during World War II was made by American farmers, yeah, including a lot of farmers, by the way, in this area as well. That's something we always forget about wartime production. We think about the tanks and the ships and the machine guns, but there was also that enormous amount of food aid that was going not just to feed our troops, but to feed the civilian populations of our allies. Yeah.
Have to take another break. My guest is Arthur Herman. The book is Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion with author Arthur Herman, author of Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. We're talking about this extraordinary mobilization that took place prior to and all through World War II. Let's take a couple of calls. Elizabeth in St. Louis, you've been very patient. Thanks for being so, and welcome.
Thank you. I haven't heard the entire program, so perhaps this has been mentioned. But the production and the speed with which it was done also took a great toll in lives.
It did.
And
that's very
my
true.
Brother was a pilot, and he flew the P-39, not 38, and was at Wright. And I went to Wright-Patterson Field and checked through the archives there. There were four men who died in 1 month's time before Bernard was killed. And the planes would go into a flat spin, and they would crash to the ground. And Bernard had been an outstanding athlete, high school, college, and he decided to bail out. Well, the plane came around, and the propeller got him.
Oh.
And this happened all over until they finally grounded these planes. And I climbed all over that airplane at Wright-Patterson, and if they'd have caught me, they'd have... I don't know what they'd have done, but I wanted to see what it was like, what it might have been like to be in that. And I just think that's something that needs to be mentioned, too, as we mobilized, that people did the best they could do.
That's
but
right.
In some instances, it was tragic for many, many people.
Can I ask you a question real quick? Was your brother, was he in the Army or was he a civilian pilot?
He was
pilot?
Air Force.
He was an Air Force pilot.
He had his wings.
Sure.
He was in the Air Force.
Well, don't forget there were also a lot of civilian pilots, too, who lost their lives
in
the process. And, you know, one of the most amazing statistics I came across was that in 1942, the number of Americans who were killed and injured in war-related industries outnumbered the number of Americans killed and wounded in action. And now this is 1942. We're talking about the year of Bataan. We're talking the year of Midway. We just celebrated the 70th anniversary of that. We're talking about the year of Guadalcanal. Outnumbered the number by a factor of 20 to 1.
You know, when I saw that in the book, I thought it was a mistake. I mean, it just seems so
incredible.
It's
staggering, isn't it?
It absolutely
and
is.
And at GM, Knudsen's own company, 189 senior executives died on the job. Right. Some cases dropping dead in their office, in some cases just not feeling well and going home and then dying after a short illness. I got an email, again, one of these great emails about someone whose grandfather was mentioned in the book, Phil Johnson, of executive at Boeing. And he said his grandfather was working on, I have a long chapter in the back, in the end of the book about the B-29, which was really Knudsen's masterpiece in terms of organizing production. Mm-hmm. And his grandfather, Phil Johnson, was supervising the B-29 effort down in Wichita, at the plant in Wichita, and died of a heart attack. And the result of it was that with wartime taxation being what it was, that 90% of was taken in estate taxes. And so you have to think about not just the people who are dying here in accidents, and in like our caller's brother in flight accidents, about 14,000 pilots killed in training accidents, but also about these senior executives who are dying at GM. It's also their family legacies that are being wiped up because they're being taxed at that wartime rate.
You know, Elizabeth brings to mind another question, and that is because so much was being produced so quickly, and a lot of it was being designed, I'm sure, just moments before the assembly line was fired up, there had to be mistakes made. There had to be some really inferior stuff that was put out there to be tested.
What I found out was that by the way, the B-39 is a classic example, is that when you look at the kinds of designs and mistakes, almost all of them were ones that were done by demands that the Army or the Navy Department placed upon the manufacturers. That almost every case, the manufacturers themselves would, whenever they could, redesign and improve the products, because that was how they were trained to think. Mm-hmm. The P-39 is a great example. It was a terrible plane when it was first designed, but Bell redesigned it. And although American pilots never liked it, even after it became a really useful and safe plane to fly, the Soviets loved it. Mm-hmm. And they were, because it was a big, heavy plane, and you could load it up with anti-tank weaponry. And so it became a big hit with the Soviets. They loved the plane. One of the reasons, if you're a World War II buff, one of the reasons why American planes, plane for plane, were generally superior to those of the Axis, especially over time, they got progressively better designs, was almost every design was by a commercially based company. And the reason why American tanks, by and large, were so inferior to that of the Axis, particularly the German tanks, was because they were designed by the Army Board of Ordnance. Mm-hmm. One of the mistakes I think that was made during this war production effort was that too often the business executives assumed that the military bureaucrats knew what they were doing and wouldn't question design questions, and that the War Department, Navy Department, didn't go more often to the commercial producers and say, can you redesign this? How would you take and correct these kinds of things?
What's the old joke about the elephant was probably designed by a committee?
And perhaps a government committee. That happens with a lot of the tanks. You're absolutely right, Don, about that. Now, in the Cold War, they learned to do that, and they began to rely more and more on the expertise of engineers at companies like North American Aviation and Republic. But during the war, a lot of these tragedies that took place was precisely because designs that were out of date and outmoded were perpetuated for the sake of getting those numbers out, getting the production going.
Let's take a call from Jerry in O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for being with us once again.
Hey, good morning. Yes, I think this is a topic that a lot of people overlook, that we essentially manufactured our way to victory. By the way, that statistic, I spent a lot of time in safety training in aviation, and we used to always bring up the fact that, I don't know if this is true in the United States, but in Britain, more pilots died in training than in combat, which led finally to a few advances in training.
And it wasn't just the British too. You know, the German, the ME-109, more pilots were killed in training accidents and in crashes than were killed by encounters with the Allies. So, not surprised.
Yes, and the conversation reminds me. I always like to plug one of my favorite movies, The Best Years of Our Lives.
Oh, that's a great film.
Should be required watching for everyone. But the scene, which I think was improvised because they ran across this huge field full of newly produced aircraft, engines, propellers, that were simply going to be turned into scrap, had never been used. And just to see that panning shot of all the, you know, all that equipment that we were able to, you know, as I say, we produced our way to victory, that unfortunately, I don't think we're no longer capable of that. But I think that's a, I think your book is a great way to highlight that fact, and I'll be certain to read it.
Great.
So thank you.
I'm glad you called.
Thanks, Jerry. Time is really beginning to get away. A couple of things that definitely have to get to. One is the role of women during this mobilization. Rosie the Riveter.
Hugely important.
And also the role of labor, which is an interesting slant on that.
Well, let's deal with the women issue first. This was, of course, everybody thinks about Rosie the Riveter, although really her real name should be Rosie the Welder.
Yeah.
Because one of the innovations that Knudsen introduced was to shift from riveting, particularly with tanks and army vehicles, to welding. And welding really comes into its own in the shipyards, in the manufacturing of heavy equipment like tanks as a result of that innovation. And the women played a huge role there. They play a huge role in the aviation industry. At any given time, in any plant you walked into, a Douglas plant, let's say, in Burbank, or a North American plant making the P-51s, third of the workforce are going to be women. In Kaiser's Richmond Shipyard, by the end of the war, 70% of the people on the payroll in the Richmond Shipyards were women. And it was a breakthrough in a number of ways. One was it was a breakthrough in breaking down male attitudes about the kind of work that women could do. And there was a lot of assumption, well, they can't, they're just not going to have the sort of skills, mental or physical, to do the kind of labor that was involved with this. But it's also a breakthrough for women as well, because I think it really changed the way in which women thought about jobs and thought about their place within the workforce. Think about just how much of your opportunities for a job, if you're a young woman, teenager, is going to be in domestic service. And now suddenly all this opportunity opened up to be involved in building tools necessary to America's future and to its defense. And making excellent money in the process and learning a whole new set of skills. And learning a whole new set of self-confidence. And I talk about in the book the diary of a woman welder in which she describes that the changes day by day of suddenly feeling like empowered as a result of the kind of work that she was involved in. The other big group, of course, too, from that standpoint, being African Americans. And they really become equals in the industrial labor force thanks to World War II, simply because there was such a shortage of labor. You have to go in that even the prejudices of employers and of unions about African Americans had to be overcome if that production was going to get underway.
And organized labor.
Organized labor. This was one of the really surprising sides of the book that I came to realize was the degree to which organized labor really dragged their feet, unlike business, about the wartime production effort from the beginning. When Knudsen begins the process of converting over, there's a lot of fear on the part of labor unions that they were going to lose all of the rights and privileges that they had won during the New Deal years. Strikes go on, not just during the period that Knudsen's in charge up to Pearl Harbor. In fact, he estimated about 25% of war production potential was lost due to strikes, but also after the war. Even though unions took a very public no-strikes pledge, the strikes go on by the thousands all the way through to the end of the war. And it was, talking about shocking statistics, the other one that really sat me back, in addition to the number of people who died in the wartime industry, was that the week of D-Day, there were 17 separate strikes in Detroit, the center of wartime production now, and 60,000 workers were out of work as a result of it.
Time is precious at this moment. Post-war, it was widely expected by many, not Mr. Knudsen nor Mr. Kaiser, I believe, that the economy was going to go south because all of this was going to stop.
Right.
But it didn't.
The thing was that if we shut off the government spigot of the flow of money coming here, that we're going to have a collapse. We're going to have all these young men coming back out of uniform, coming back into the civilian workforce. That scene that Jerry was talking about in Best Years of Our Lives, all this stuff had to be junked. It's true. This was all wartime production. Even though we almost doubled GNP, the addition to national wealth was almost none because it was stuff to be blown up and blow other things up. Mm-hmm. But Knudsen had the right idea, and that was is that once you got American productivity back on its feet, you got these companies first to convert from civilian production, refrigerators to machine guns, but then you got them back into refrigerators again. Well, they're going to learn. They're going to come in leaner. They're going to come in with a sense of confidence, with a sense that they can accomplish and do anything. And they're going to be able to supply to a consumer-based economy what they've been supplying to a government order-based economy for the last 4 years. And he turned out to be exactly right.
And part of that, as you point out in your book, is the fact that Rosie the Welder, if you will, Rosie the Riveter, didn't stay on the assembly line, opening up job opportunities for the men who are coming back.
And also the GI Bill, which took a lot of veterans out of the labor market for 2 or 3 years and allowed the mobility of labor to return to the places where labor was really going to be in demand and where civilian production was going to be directed. It really did sort itself out in ways that really astonished officials in Washington, but really didn't surprise people who understood what this economy could really do once you gear it up and once you set it loose.
2 minutes left.
Sure.
The big question is, could we do the same thing today?
Well, now, we had a caller who asked about that and sort of gave the answer in the negative. I am an optimist about this, Don. I think we could. And I think that the problem is that when we think about not just preparing for war, but about how you gear an economy up. This was the larger picture that Knudsen had in the back of his mind, that the place that you look is going to be to the most innovative and the most productive companies. And I think that's one of the problems, just to go to our issues about the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, and that is what they haven't done. You know, what would happen if they went to Apple and said, design us the new iFighter? If they went to Google and said, we need a software architecture for running our ships and submarines, how do you do that? What's the most cost-effective way to do that? Now, the next big conflict that America gets involved in, the next generation of weapons and warfare, isn't going to be fought with tanks and with it's going to be cyber warfare. It's going to be robotics and unmanned systems. And if you do the Knudsen model, if you take his approach, as I explain in the book, and you mobilize those most innovative companies like an Apple, like a Google, like the other offshoots that and competitors in the process, I think you're going to sort of see, including manufacturers, the new advanced manufacturing companies that are coming into place, I think you can see an arsenal democracy, a new one rising up out of this country in unexpected ways, just as this one was so unexpected at the time.
In 30 seconds, even with the global interaction among so many of the companies, I mean, there are so many moving parts to these corporations anymore.
Well, that was true then, too. I mean, GM was an international company. So was Ford. I think the appeal to challenge is number one, which is always appealing to American business and American engineering. The appeal to patriotism, the industrial base is there. It's ready to get started again. And I think for us, it could be set off again as it was in 1940-41.
Let's end this conversation on that optimistic note. You've been listening to Arthur Herman. His book is Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. With you. Thank you so much, Arthur, for being with us.
It's been an enormous pleasure.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.